All right, we are in the next incarnation of the C-Sharp design team. Hi, Anders. I guess you can introduce yourself. Everyone knows you.
I'm Anders Asberg, chief designer of C-Sharp.
Excellent.
We're doing intros? All right.
Doing intros.
I'm Scott Wiltemuth. I'm one of the C-Sharp language designers.
I'm Matt Warren. I'm some random architect who thought they were going to be donuts.
I'm Jim Huguenin. I came to Microsoft with Iron Python, which is bringing those dynamic languages, and now I'm having fun here talking about dynamic features in .NET runtime and in cool languages like C#.
All right.
Matt Jorgensen, language PM for C#.
Absolutely.
Hi, I'm Eric Lippert. I am a developer on the C# compiler team.
All right. And you've been on Channel 9 before.
I have.
Very long time ago.
Many a time.
Many a time. So let's talk a little about this. Oh, my goodness. And the most
important. I'm used to.
Well, you're sitting on my right side. I can't see out of my right eye.
I'm Paul Vick. I'm the architect, language architect on Visual Basic.
Outstanding. Please forgive me.
That's okay.
So, you know, that sort of brings up the next point. This is a new cast of characters, Anders, since the last time we talked. What's going on here?
Well, so first of all, I should say that we are in the room that literally C# was conceived in this room.
Wow.
This is room 2543 in building 41. And
nice.
We have been meeting here for 9 years, I think. Actually, there were some early meetings, probably, where I think we were all in building 42. But strangely, we have just kept meeting in this room throughout, and then 3 times a week, you know, for 9+ years.
Wow.
Yeah. So we know every inch of this little place here.
Excellent.
You can't expect a big team of people to be completely coherent over a time span of 9 years or so. So there's always some circulation on the C# design team. The people you see here, most of us worked on C# 3.0. Jim recently joined. Paul has always been involved in some capacity. And now we're all, you know, working on C# 4.0.
Excellent. But I guess you do shuffle people out for a reason, right? I mean, you're trying to get new ideas, new perspectives. I mean, you have a VB person in the room.
Right.
It's a very different language, you know, semantically than C#. If they're in the room, then we have a dynamic guy, and then we have the donut architect over here. So, you know, what's your thinking behind this, bringing these people together?
Well, I think it's new blood is important, but consistency is important, too. So we try to, you know, be conscious of both. These days, dynamic languages are very important, so it's important for us to have Jim on our team here. Link has been a big thing, and Matt Warren was the Link to SQL architect. You know, VB and C# have always sort of gone hand in hand, so we try to compose the team as, you know, as best we can. Scott actually has pretty much been with it from the beginning, as have I. Well,
I took a detour.
You took a detour into management for a while there. And now you've found the true path again.
I remember that from our last interview. You mentioned something along the lines of working remotely from Maui or something.
Yeah. So when we first started doing C# 1.0, I was doing the role that Mads is doing now. So I was PMing the team. We were, you know, getting people together to talk about what kind of language we wanted to have. And I was doing a lot of that from Hawaii. So I lived on Oahu for 4 years while my wife was doing her medical residency. And then I came back and I did a more traditional role where I was here in person. I took a detour.
Old school.
And so the last couple product cycles, I've been less involved in the technical work and been managing the team. So I managed the C# product unit, and then I managed a bigger organization after that. And I'm kind of back to my roots now.
Cool. So the last time that we talked, we were sort of talking about Link. We were talking about adding functional constructs into the language to support parallelism and various other things. What were your big target areas for this release? What have you guys been meeting about over the past year or so?
Well, let me talk about it as opposed to talking specifically about like what are the features, because that's still somewhat in flux. You know, the big influencers right now are. The notion of more declarative ways of doing your programming, and you can think of Link as one manifestation of that. It's dynamic languages have sort of seen a resurgence, and it's interesting to understand why and how that affects statically typed languages. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, concurrency is the big elephant in the room that everybody, right, I mean everybody, has to deal with. And so we're thinking about that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So those are sort of the three broad themes, if you will, that shape our thinking.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So what are some, without getting specific, I mean, what are some of these things that you've been thinking up that we should be looking forward to?
Without being specific?
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Without mentioning names. I don't know. I mean, let's just talk a little bit about, like, you know, how the language is evolving and changing.
Sure. So I think one of the things that you're seeing in this time frame is that the family of .NET languages from Microsoft is growing bigger and more diverse. Mm-hmm. Right? We have seen F# come out as a functional language, and we're seeing the dynamic languages, Iron Ruby, Iron Python. Probably more languages will join on the DLR, which is a common execution framework for all things dynamic. Mm-hmm. And so we live in a bigger and bigger world, and C# has to be a citizen of this bigger world too and interact well with all these languages. Mm-hmm. It's currently, if you try out Iron Python, it's really nicely integrated into .NET in the sense that you can go and call everything inside of the .NET framework and so on. It has a really smooth integration experience from that side, but it gets a lot more clunky when you want to go the other way. Mm-hmm. So if I'm in C# and somebody wrote a nice piece of code in Iron Python, it might not be so easy for me to interact with that.
Absolutely.
So that's a reality we have to adjust to, and we're happy to do so too.
Interesting. Very cool. And so why are dynamic languages so popular right now? I mean, Eric, you're a big JavaScript guy from the day. And, you know, people sort of sometimes make fun of JavaScript as a sort of this strange kind of interpreted language. It's hard to program with without any sort of help. You use Notepad, you use something else. It's a weird language, but it's powerful, and lots of people use it and will continue to use it. So let's talk a little bit about this dynamic language stuff.
Sure. Yeah, I worked on the JScript and VBScript teams for many, many years before I eventually came here. And you know, something that I joke with these guys about all the time is like, oh, we're finally bringing C# to the point where you can do the same things in it that you could do in JScript, you know, 8 years ago. JScript has a lot of really interesting features in it. It's got a lot of sort of functional language features. You know, it always supported closures and first-class functions and nested functions and things like that. And as we've started adding things like, you know, true lambda expressions to C#3 and things like that, we've sort of come up to that point as well that JScript was already at. The thing is, you know, you think about programming languages as they're tools, right? They're communications tools as well as being, you know, specifications for devices. You know, you build a program and it goes and it does something. Mm-hmm. And so I think of the power of a language as being, how much work do I have to do as a developer in order to get my task done? Right? You know, people say, you know, programmers don't want drills, they want holes in objects, right? And the drill is just the tool that they use to get there. So what's the best tool that we can give them? And for some applications, you just really want to get it, you know, developed as fast as you possibly can, and you know how the system works, and you just want to write programs that do what you mean, right? Mm-hmm. And then maybe in larger systems, more complicated systems where you've got dozens or hundreds of people working on it over a large span of time, maybe you would like more of the mechanisms that you're building to have invariants that are enforced by the compiler, where one person doesn't understand how the whole thing works from start to finish. And in those kinds of situations, you think, well, maybe a statically typed language would be more appropriate. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a spectrum, and you know, I throughout my day, you know, will write little programs to do things, you know, in C++ or in C# or in JScript or in VBScript, depending on what I need to do.
Exactly. So it's use the right tool for the job. So, you know, as language designers, then I would ask, why would you want to change a statically typed language like C sharp and an imperative language? Why make it more functional? Why make it more dynamic? Just leave it alone, and if you want to do something in dynamic, write it in dynamic code.
I think, you know, Matt's talked about this a little bit, but for me, a lot of it comes down to the way that everything gets shared. And, you know, it comes back to sort of the .NET framework and having as many things as possible be shareable across the languages. So, and it's just stepping back for a moment, right? You know, when I first started looking at the DLR at Microsoft, I thought that this was this thing that was all about dynamic languages. And we were looking at, you know, how are we going to make Python and Ruby and these languages run better? We were doing crazy things there, like building up syntax trees and statement trees, because we thought this was a really important way for the languages to work. We got further and further along, and when we got far along, we started to realize that what we were doing looked a lot like what these guys had been doing, creating expression trees in order to do link. Mm. And so it's this sort of classic realization that you have kind of everywhere you go, that, you know, this thing that you think's about dynamic languages and this thing that, you know, they think's about functional languages and declarative programming are actually really close to the same thing. And there are many of these things where you have these concepts, and, you know, now, you know, if you take the two ideas and put them together, you wind up with something better that everybody can share. The benefits of, so with the .NET approach, it's not that we want to make C-sharp a dynamic language, right? You know, that C-sharp is a static language. That's its history. It's done an amazing job of taking a lot of good ideas from other languages and put them into a static language for the first time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, for me, some of my favorite examples, like, I used to love to write Python programs with generators, iterators or what C-sharp calls them. And I used to love to say, this is why it's so much better than these static languages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, C-sharp has taken that and adopted it as a, in its own way, right, in a way that worked for the static language world. So stealing those ideas is great. Mm-hmm. And where you can't steal the ideas, if you made C-sharp a truly dynamic language, you would change what it was. Absolutely. But you can add some dynamic capabilities to it by adding them to the .NET framework, by adding this notion of dynamic dispatch to the .NET framework, which is what we're doing with the DLR and extending the .NET framework, so that dynamic dispatch is now something that the framework understands. And having the language understand that, now C-sharp can work well with all these dynamic languages that are out there. So when Eric decides that he wants to write some interesting little bit of JavaScript code, if he has some C-sharp code that he wants to have used that someday, he can do that. So people still get to choose the language that they want, and they don't balkanize themselves into one particular world. Just because I want to use Python doesn't mean that, you know, I should only be able to work with the Python libraries. I really want to be able to take advantage of all the other cool things that are out there on .NET.
That's true.
And there's an interesting... It's funny, you know, because when people think about dynamic languages, people tend to, generally speaking, marry dynamic languages with loose typing and marry static languages with strong typing. Mm-hmm. And this frames many discussions, and it's almost, in some discussions, it never even comes up, and it's just sort of the subtext. And it doesn't actually have to be that way. And if you look at some of the infrastructure that we've started to build with Link, we're moving towards a complete system for dynamic program construction that has the capability to be strongly typed. You know, link expression trees, for example, are, well, we can quickly agree that they're dynamic. You can put them together and whatever, and then you can say dot compile and get IL, and then you can run that. Mm-hmm. But they're also strongly typed. And they will be type checked. When you say dot compile, if there's a problem in this expression tree, it ain't going to compile, and it ain't going to blow up. And if you run it 1,000 times, you only have the overhead of compiling it once. Mm-hmm. So there, we're sort of starting to mess with some of the classical ways that these systems are put together. And dynamic dispatch is an important part of it. But also, I would say, dynamic construction of statically typed code is super important, too. And not something that a lot of systems have done very well previously. And I find that very interesting. And then, you know, you combine them all together in this happy universe, and that's really what Jim is talking about with adding the DLR. It's really, in a sense, we're adding these capabilities that we see missing, right? Mm-hmm. And there are other capabilities that you know, over time we would like to add, like make it easier to use the compiler at runtime, you know, so you can, you know, like, use the compiler more as a service and less as, you know, a command line tool. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's sort of more part, again, of this whole universe of making dynamic program construction complete, if you will, because right now it is very sort of very ragged universe, you know, with some things you can do, but others you can't.
Interesting.
You know,
You think about sorry, when you think about the world of scripting languages today, right? And it's very interesting. If I want to, if I've got a program and I want to embed a language inside of it, and I want to have a language that I can, you know, have little callbacks for menu items, it's always done with scripting languages today. Who knows which scripting language, but it's always done with a dynamically typed language. And this is interesting, sort of to Andrew's point. You know, the reason that it's done with a dynamic typing doesn't have anything to do with what makes for a good scripting language. What makes for a good scripting language is a language that can very easily be embedded and hosted, that you can easily take a little bit of code, turn it into something that you can run in your applications environment. And that's kind of the essence of what it means to be a good embeddable scripting language. Hmm. And it's interesting to sort of start teasing these things apart, that that dynamic code creation is the key part of dynamic languages and why they've been successful as scripting languages, rather than the dynamic typing. Dynamic typing is useful for other purposes, but if you tease them apart, then you start to be able to say, you know, wouldn't it be nice to think about statically typed languages as useful scripting languages, so long as they had the dynamic code generation and dynamic execution in different environments. And you get a lot of power out there and a lot more flexibility. And, you know, people who feel that types are very important to them all of a sudden don't have to use a dynamically typed language just because they want to extend, you know, some application with some script code.
Interesting.
And I mean, I've seen, like in the last year or two, I've seen most of the uptake I've seen internally inside of Microsoft for Python has been these scripting scenarios, like where there's nothing intrinsic necessarily about the Python language or even the DLR. It's just the fact that, hey, they needed a language to embed to do some scripting, and you know that was what we've got at the moment. So yeah, I think it's definitely and in a sense it kind of takes us back to the future, because you know, I mean, that's where we, you know, VBA and, you know, VBA, that's all of, you know, 90% of probably VBA, VB code is produced in, you know, the scripting VBA scenario, so.
Interesting. So, I mean, why? Let's step a little bit back into, I mean, why do you think languages like Ruby are so popular? What's going on? What is so popular about this language? That's a purely dynamic language, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, when you look over the industry.
I mean, if I had to take, my guess, because I don't know this to be the manifest truth, but I actually think in some ways Ruby is popular in spite of the loose typing, and more because of its good metaprogramming facilities. Ruby has very strong eval capabilities and the ability for programs to dynamically generate themselves. And if you look at Ruby on Rails, that is exactly what powers Rails. I mean, it is not the dynamicness of the dynamic dispatch and whatever. It is the strong metaprogramming. Now, as you dig deeper, of course, you realize that doing these strong metaprogramming things is much more complicated in a strongly typed world. Mm-hmm. But if you go back in history, lots of things were more complicated to do in a strongly typed world. Mm-hmm. Yet once they get done, you know, you along with them come a bunch of desirable capabilities. You know, like,
sure,
like better tooling, better refactoring, better performance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, like a lot of people simply will not give up statement completion. You know, it is too powerful of a tool in day-to-day programming. You know, and mm-hmm. that's something that most dynamic languages make you give up. Maybe not always, but most of the time. And that's a high price to pay. You really, you're flying without a safety net there. You kind of got to know what you're doing. But I would say, yeah, I would say it's the metaprogramming facilities that are powering what we're seeing there with Ruby, and especially with Ruby on Rails.
Okay.
So the one other thing, though, that I see with Ruby, I mean, I think I agree with Anders that it's the metaprogramming, with the caveat that it's a heck of a lot easier to do great metaprogramming with dynamic typing, and it'd be great to do it both ways.
Well, with no typing, yeah. in a sense, but yeah.
Dynamic typing, sure. The
yeah.
other thing that Rails has, and that a lot of the dynamic languages have that's hard to bring, you know, a lot of Rails is a reaction to J2EE. As far as I can tell, you know, following the Rails community,
yeah.
A lot of their excitement is J2EE is this huge, incredibly complicated framework that, you know, has this incredible conceptual overhead and lots of things that you need to understand, and is incredibly heavyweight. And the notion, you know, Rails is a heck of a lot simpler.
Yeah.
And having a much simpler thing that's very easy to approach and get started with and write small amounts of code, and doing things like using the metaprogramming capabilities and the ability to eval code in different contexts in order to make it simple.
Mm-hmm.
But giving that simplicity is something that Rails really did extremely well in. And it's, you know, that's something that, you know, and I think that's a little bit of a lesson. You know, I don't think we have anything that looks anywhere near the complexity of J2E, but Rails has certainly shown developers' desire for simplicity and for that simple start. Of course, there's other, you know, fun examples of Rails having trouble sometimes when it gets out of that simple area. And, you know, I don't want to get any hate mail by mentioning anything specifically, but it's incredibly good when it's doing simple things. And that's attractive to people, making simple things simple.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, recently there was something along the lines of Ruby having a hard time scaling. I can't remember the name of that popular site. Was it Twitter? Mm-hmm. But anyway, I think it was just bad code that person wrote as opposed to blaming it on the framework. So I think none of us will get hate mail now. but it's interesting. Because, you know, you've said this many times, Anders, and the many times that we've had you on Channel 9, you always talk about the fact that the real power of our managed story is in the framework, right? The CLR, then the base class library on top of it, and then the programming languages are thin wrappers. So we've always tried to make it easier for programmers to do things. So I guess one could ask, you know, why continue to evolve C# and not just spend all the time on evolving the CLR and the base class library? And then I can call a class that dynamically generates statically typed code as opposed to having it in my language.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really very simple. I mean, in the sense that let me when we evolve C#, it is all gravy. I mean, we make nobody unhappy and we give people more capabilities. Everything we do incrementally to C# is nothing but goodness, right? Now, you could argue that it does add to the gravity of the language, and over time, you know, the language gets bigger, and there is some detraction there. Mm-hmm. But contrast this with, let's say we wanted to have language-integrated query, but we had to dream up a whole new language to get language-integrated query. Well, where's the leverage, right? I mean, it's like...
True.
I have this sort of analogy whenever, or measuring stick, when people... come to me with, you know, an idea for a new API or a new feature or whatever, it is almost invariably a feature that already exists in some form and now they want to make it better, right? Mm-hmm. It is never a green field and wholly new. And so I always tell them, well, you're going to start out with a -1,000 points for making people go through the pain of moving to your new API or your new feature and whatever. Mm-hmm. And now show me how you win back those 1,000 points. Because until then, you have not provided value. And we are guilty, and most companies are guilty of shipping -500 pointers, you know, which is you do add value, but you do not add enough value. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
And it's important to understand that if you can evolve something, you don't start out with -1,000 points. You start out at zero. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So I'm very happy with the fact that we've been able to evolve C# and add generic typing and language integrated query, and then now we're thinking about dynamic features and metaprogramming and whatever. And you know, I think it is pure goodness to do this. So we're going to keep at it.
Can I add something?
Please.
I think that your question was, instead of working on the language, why aren't we working on extending the libraries? And I think that we actually do extend the libraries quite a bit. In fact, a lot of the things that we think about as language features, we have to debate quite a bit about whether they should be language features or they should just be library features. Mm-hmm. And if the language really can't add value there, and we really want to do them, we make them as library features.
Interesting. I mean, that's actually a great conversation point.
I was going to say that frequently also we're enabling the library folks to have more expressive ways of expressing their library things as well. So kind of between the language work we do and the work we do in kind of in .NET framework, we provide the building blocks for building those libraries. And so Link is a good example where, you know, we've defined a new set of building blocks that enable you to create these APIs that have this expressive power that it wasn't possible to do before. And it's kind of the combination of the language and the underlying .NET building blocks that enable that. And one of the things that we do in coordinating the meeting is get the library folks in here to talk and know, well, you know, what problems do you have that we could potentially help you solve? And we kind of have that interchange with the folks on the class library teams to try to find those next conceptual building blocks that will provide greater expressive power, and it helps the library folks, it helps the consumers of the libraries as well. Mm-hmm. And that's a very fertile area for us, and we frequently use that as a test for a new language feature. Well, who's going to be using it in the class libraries that we deliver? And if we can't find examples, it doesn't rule it out, because you know we're not developing all the class libraries for the world, but we certainly use that as an indicator for whether there's a lot of value in the feature.
Interesting.
Right. Or here's a maybe a fourth, or I've lost count, maybe a fifth way of looking at it, which is there are, you know, the classes and objects and whatnot of the libraries, and there are the languages that you use to talk to them. But there's a third thing as well, which is people use design patterns, right, when they are building solutions. And you know, it's been said that design patterns are nothing more than a failure of a programming language to have some abstraction that is useful. Right? So when I look at people that are using design patterns, like building iterators, right, for example, in C# 1, you think, well, is this so powerful and so important an abstraction that it really deserves to be sort of promoted into the language itself, so that it's really a first-class thing, so that everybody can make a very easy use of this thing, rather than having to go through all of the work of defining all of the classes and fields and finite state machines and whatnot that go into making an iterator. Mm. So when I think about, well, why are we evolving the C# language, right? That's a big part of it, right? It's not just, is what we are doing appropriate, you know, for something that could go into a library, but is it not even sort of conceptually the kind of thing that could go into a library, right? Is it not a thing, but rather a pattern that we can embed into the language?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that, I mean, there's a group of very sharp folks, and Anders, you sort of oversee the team that's doing the parallel computing platform, or Parallel FX, Joe Duffy and the gang of great developers over there. But I guess one question I would ask would, you know, wouldn't that be an example of where you could have in the language, you could just mark something as, you know, this target, this could be running on multiple cores, so I'm going to check, write this little thing here declaratively that says, write the code as if it were targeting several cores, and then let the machine handle all the work instead of me having to play around with parallel.for, parallel.while, or whatever else is going on in the library.
So I would just ask, you know, clearly there's very good reasons why that's not the case, I would imagine, but is that an example of where, because what he was just saying, it would be useful as a developer not to have to rely on a library to handle something that I really shouldn't care about, right? Because that's where we're going with that.
Yeah, and once paradigms become, or patterns become common enough, we do tend to capture them in syntax. Like, that's why we have a for each statement in C#, right? Or iterators, or link query expressions and so forth. And certainly one could imagine having a parallel dot four, or sorry, a parallel for, where you don't have to say the dot and it's keywords. And but the thing to keep in mind there is that when you say parallel for, parallel by what definition of parallel? I mean, are you going to run multiple threads, or who's going to do the scheduling, and whatever? And there are a bunch of details underneath, right? And until one sort of winning threading model emerges, or one concurrency model emerges as being the one, we would do ourselves a big disservice by tying the language to a particular form of concurrency. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Because we'd go down with that piece of concurrency if that ended up not being the winner in the game. So you always have to have a level of separation where, you know, you don't make it manifest in syntax until you are 100% certain that this is the way you do it. And even then, you tend to try to find extension points. Like for each is an example there where, yeah, I mean, we all know that you want to be able to enumerate over a collection, but we're not going to say exactly how, right? Mm. And for a parallel loop, you know, it's certainly imperative that we, well, I should not use the word imperative. it would be important that it be possible for us to plug in different implementations of parallelism under that. And so you'll probably see us think more not about like the very specific exact, you know, like capabilities, but rather think about the concepts that support building libraries around those capabilities. Like function purity would be an important thing. If the compiler could say something about whether a function is pure, i.e. the function has no side effects when it executes, it doesn't. You can execute as many times you want on as many threads as you want, and then nothing will step on anything.
Mm-hmm.
If that was captured in the language and you could have purity guarantees, you know, then all of a sudden you could start doing automatic parallelization because the language can deliver you a guarantee, you know, and then you wouldn't even have to say parallel.for. You would just do your set operation and we'd go figure out whether to do it parallel or not. So that's sort of one area that, and along with purity then comes immutability, because that's, you know, how you can guarantee purity is by having immutable objects. And but you probably also want to think about isolation, you know, like how can we say that something is isolated or safe, or there's only one thread of execution here. What could we do in the language to build isolation domains and isolation guarantees? And so these are things that we think about,
sure,
you know, and that eventually we'll make it into language features, but I couldn't tell you.
That's cool. I mean,
right now, when? But
well, I mean, for example, I know we laugh. You know, I spent a fair amount of time with Eric Meyer, like we did at JAU and whatnot, and he's very on the extreme side, as you know, of everyone should be writing functional programming.
Sure.
It has to, you know, this is the only way it can be purely, you know, be pure is to write functional. But for developers, it's a little too cumbersome, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in my mind, the answer is rarely at the extreme, right? And, and we have, for better or for worse, taught generations of programmers how to write imperative code.
Yes.
With shared state and manual threading and... And now we got to go repair that, but you don't repair it by, you know, Dell *** and format your hard drive and then start all over, right?
Agreed.
I mean, because, again, that's like a minus 1 million pointer right there.
For both the code and the developers. You can't just Dell the code. Like, you have the same developers.
But you could, but like you were saying, you could leverage the machine, the big giant machine underneath, in this case the CLR, to do a lot of that stuff for you. Because there is something to be said for if a function is supposed to return a Boolean, and it always returns a Boolean. End of story. I mean, there's power in that alone. Because that's not the case today.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, we'd still be able to say that, but I mean, that doesn't say anything about how the function executes. I'm not implying here that it wouldn't be strongly typed or
did it write to the console before returning the Boolean?
Yeah, well, that's more like a question of, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Or did it throw an exception?
Exactly.
Because an exception is not a Boolean.
Yeah.
Whereas in a functional language, it won't. That will not be the case because you're guaranteed, perhaps, that it's not going to throw an exception. Right, that's what I meant.
Unless it runs out of memory, or
it's
amazing the kinds of guarantees
that
you get from functional and typing worlds, right?
On
and so it's but
it's a fun debate.
But all the guarantees. I mean, for me, the debate. I mean, you know, I'm the dynamic language guy here, so I see the debate from there. But even from the functional side, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's the whole, you know, the Turing world. In an abstract computer science world, you can say this never throws an exception.
Yeah.
But you know, in the real world, you know, if there's any, you know, you're touching disk, touching memory, touching network, you know, if you're not touching any of these things, you probably don't have a program that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are touching these things, saying that, you know, this never returns an exception is absurd, right? So there's very few things that are truly that pure. So, and it's just, this is that we've got to live in a world in the middle, right? We live in an impure world,
mm-hmm.
and we want to make it, you know, as good as we can, which is kind of the things to make it as good as we can, but, you know, we can't make it perfect. And most of the claims that it's perfect aren't true.
True.
That's return true.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I wonder if we should talk about the design process.
Return true only works if you don't have a Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
Right?
I wonder if we should talk about the design process. Like, Anders did an internal presentation a couple weeks ago where he talked a little bit about the C-sharp design process. We talked about the room and that we've been here for 9 years.
Well, this is Channel 9. We keep it simple.
I helped Anders make his slides, but I actually didn't get to hear what he said, so I'd be interested in hearing some of his thoughts.
Well, it was primarily a talk about architects and architecture, you know.
Yeah,
that's always interesting.
Interesting to
or technical fellows
try to understand what architecture is, if anyone understands it. But
anyway, I thought it'd be useful to talk about the process of how do we go about doing the design work that we do here, and it's you know, I don't think we have an algorithm for it. But I think some discussion on that.
I think the thing that has been, you know, the one thing that has been important about the C# design team is the continuity of the process. You know, it's effectively we have practiced continuous design. You know, in this team by meeting for that long of a time, 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of build a shared understanding among a team of 5 or 6 people of exactly what the philosophy and the gestalt of the problem at hand is, and in this case, C#.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that, you know, when you're, for example, when you're in the shower one morning and you get a good idea, all good ideas occur to you in the shower, right?
They
and
do.
Now, and now, and now, you go in and you can immediately, you know, if you're not meeting that day, you're meeting the next day, and you can immediately engage in a deep conversation about this particular solution to this particular feature with 5 or 6 people that have a shared understanding of the problem, where often design ends up happening in spurts, or in, you know, it's you know, you do a bunch of design and then everybody disperses, and then, you know, mm-hmm. later a problem comes up and they're not around, or only one of them is around, and or you gotta like find some other guy to bounce it off of, and now but they don't have the same context, so now you gotta spend 45 minutes level setting before you can even ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
But by having continuity, you get, you know, much more effective time on the things that move the product forward.
Sure.
And that has been really valuable. We've also been very good at keeping notes from our meetings here, and so we actually have a collective memory in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny, just the other day, someone was talking about a particular feature that was sorely needed in another project, and some language feature, and we could go back to our notes from 8 years ago, and there was the design for this feature. We ended up not implementing this design in the language, but there it is, you know, and you know, people thought we were
clairvoyant. I think this is a really interesting issue. Charles is asking about, you know, why do we continue evolving the language, and it's not like we just like keep thinking up new things and putting them in the language. We spend a lot of time thinking about things, and then there's a certain bar for something to get into the language. So, and we've been really good at, sometimes we'll spend a lot of time on an issue and then we'll decide to do nothing.
Right.
And that's a fine result. And we don't feel bad about that at all. Like, we had an issue we were talking about over the last couple months that we, I don't know, before I spent, you know, 10 hours of design meetings or something on it, and a bunch of time in between, and people writing up notes and all this stuff. And at the end, we're I don't really think we should do that.
No, that
it's not really, no, it's not going to be.
Well, the multi-core thing is just,
it's a fad.
In truth, the only thing that actually really is guaranteed to get done out of a design meeting is a quote of the day.
Very cool.
Yeah.
That's true. So when we do the notes, so Mads usually does the notes, but I've been filling in for a couple weeks, and there's always a quote of the day. I think we had a meeting while Mads was gone that we didn't have a quote of the day. So the notes start with, like, when did we talk about and what was the quote of the day?
What's one of the best quote of the days? Come on. Does anyone remember?
Well, I'll give you an example. The quote of the day might be, in order to understand recursion, you must first understand recursion.
That's a good one.
That would be a quote.
Well, what's the other one?
Dot, dot, dot.
You understand with me, but you just don't know it yet. You'll agree with me, but you just don't know it yet. I think that's what it was.
The real reason why the notes have restricted access and are internal are because they're quote of the day. It's not really the trade secret.
Sure. Absolutely. So, you know, one thing I would ask is, when designing, you know, applications or architectures or whatever, sometimes it's good just to be left alone. And so I would ask, you know, clearly by having several smart and talented and people with, you know, a big history and, you know, experts in domains that are going to help you, you know, do you ever feel that it would be nice if you could just sit alone in a black box and write your new versions of C#?
Well, I actually do that.
The only three that Eric got in this box.
Yeah.
He looks a little pale.
Definitely.
I thought that's what Tuesdays and Thursdays
are.
True.
I work at home 2 days a week, where I do get to do a lot of thinking. But no, I would not want to. And nothing good is designed in a vacuum. And it is super important to have time to think,
mm-hmm.
but also have time to vent the ideas in a forum of people that can shed new light and new perspective on the ideas.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So what are some of the hardest kind of problems you guys have been working on? Like, what, like, with, again, without getting into specifics, although by this point people get that you're working on some dynamic stuff, maybe, nothing's
No, sure. We never said that.
But I guess, looking out a little bit, what are some of the big, kind of big issues that you're kind of thinking about? Clearly security is always on top of mind.
Well, yeah, but concurrency, I think, is by far.
Just the
right
one.
Right now, it is so profoundly game-changing, you know, if I mean, we have, it's funny, people, you know, so people talk about Moore's Law and this, and Moore's Law actually hasn't changed, right? I mean, Moore's Law talks about doubling the number of transistors every 18 months, you know, mm-hmm. on a particular area.
Sure.
And that actually continues and looks like it's going to continue for another 10 years. But what has gone hand in hand with Moore's Law all these years is also cranking up the clock speed every 18 months or so. And that stopped. That has literally stopped. And now we're getting more, but it isn't getting faster. Mm-hmm. And so the way we get the more is by getting more CPUs. And we've sort of been at liberty, because of the adjunct to Moore's Law, the cranking up of the clock speed, we've been at liberty to ignore concurrency. You know, mm-hmm. we're still going to go faster even if we ignore it.
Sure.
Well, now, if we wanted to still go faster, we got to pay attention to concurrency and find better ways of doing it. Mm-hmm. And it's a hard problem, which is why so many people have ignored it, because it's so damn hard.
Absolutely.
So it's something that we need to think about. And to me, that I see that as a very big challenge. I do.
Even at the language level, as we were talking
about. Well, I think it's system-wide, right?
Yeah. It's really a programming model problem. How do you get developers to express their intent in a way that can be scheduled across all these processors? Right. And so it's a programming model problem, and it will include libraries and languages and runtimes, and you know that's for any big problem, that tends to be the result, is that it impacts that whole set of things. And what we try to do is, well, we want to cover the language part, obviously, but we want to influence the design of all of those things such that it adds up to a very expressive programming model.
Excellent. Well, that brings up a really good point, briefly, just so, and then I'll get to Eric, because he'll comment on what we were just talking about, but the interaction between, you guys are way up on top of the big machine, yet you have ideas that will affect little things inside of the machine, little constructs that other things will be able to use. And vice versa, they'll have some new idea that will enable you to create a new feature. So that's just an interesting point.
Yeah, that interplay definitely goes both directions. Sometimes there's something that's happening that's deep that we're kind of responding to, and we mm-hmm. kind of talked about the dynamic features in DLR as an example of that. And then it's like, hey, this is a big thing that's happening for the system as a whole. What uh-huh. should we be doing to interrelate with that well? And sometimes it's the opposite, where we have a big initiative and we want to drive changes deeper in the system to be done the right way. And I think generics and Link are both fantastic examples.
And Link wasn't just, you know, query syntax in C#, right? Link was an implementation of Link to Objects, Link to XML, Link to SQL. Mm-hmm. And Link to Objects was designed in this room. Link to SQL was designed in this room by a lot of the same people on this team. So there's strong overlap there. You know, we don't just think language. You know, we try to think language, but in context.
Right on. Yeah. And Link is a monad, right?
Sure.
Link is a monad. Functional programming. Yeah. Gotta love that.
For some definition of monad.
Exactly. And they only told us afterwards.
Would you send me a mail when you come up with that definition?
Nice. So, Eric, you're going to...
Oh, I was just going to say that the thing that terrifies me about this whole concurrency thing uh-huh. is that... You know, you look at historically, like what do we know as a civilization? It's like, well, we have 50 or 60 years of experience with functional programming, query comprehensions. People have been studying for 20 plus years. We still have major disagreement amongst learned academics with multiple PhDs who have been studying concurrency their whole lives mm-hmm. on what the right concurrency model is. Right, and so that makes it hard to know that we're even on the right track, you know. Mm-hmm. When we were adding, iterators or generics or whatever to C#, we kind of knew that there was prior art, and people had been doing experiments in academia, and we could look at that work and take the best of it. It's not clear what the best thing to do is for concurrency right now.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, one thing is for sure is that based on the way that we are moving levels of abstraction farther and farther away from the machine,
mm-hmm.
general-purpose programmers targeting .NET shouldn't... We should really don't want them to think about concurrency. Right?
Yes.
It's another one of those things. It should just be something that I don't have to spend... Now, you could argue, well, wait a minute, that's not always
true.
You don't.
I would modify that a little bit.
Sure.
You don't want them to think about the gory details of orchestrating concurrent execution.
Yes.
You do want them to think about the fact that this might run concurrently, and we want to give them a good framework for expressing that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it is foolish to think that we're going to just somehow be able to pepper concurrency on, and you wouldn't even have to modify anything in your apps today for them to run concurrently.
Okay.
Because a lot of shared state applications, you know, we're just not going to be able to tease out of them the places where we could put the concurrency. But the hope here is that we can build programming models that are sufficiently close to what you know, and sufficiently applicable in your existing programs that you can start to take advantage of this concurrency without having to just like throw away everything. You know?
But let me ask you this question though. I mean, since you have a generation of general purpose programmers, not kernel developers, not rocket science type developers, that are single threaded. They think in a single threaded kind of way. Now all of a sudden, how are they going to know? Wait a minute, this chunk of code should really run in parallel. If they don't know that already, how is that going to help them?
So well, but the way you want them to think about the bigger picture, like it's if what you're doing is a set operation or a matrix operation or an image transform or whatever, well, you could either immediately fall down and start like poking on every bit or for looping over your data or whatever, or we can hopefully build programming models that allow you to express that in a more set-oriented fashion where you say, here's the data, here are the operations expressed in pure functional way or with lambdas or what have you, right? And here are all the pieces.
Uh-huh.
Here, you engine, go away and do this work for me now, okay? And if you can harvest concurrency underneath, power to you, right?
Okay.
That, I think, is entirely doable for a lot of classes of problems that are out there. But it takes for us to do certain things in the programming, like because... We want to be, you know, we can't quite do that right now because we can't, if you give us a piece of code,
mm-hmm.
the compiler can't guarantee that the piece of code you give us is not going to have side effects. And therefore, the engine can't guarantee that some fuse isn't going to pop over on the other side of the spacecraft here when you call this method. Do,
mm-hmm.
do you know what I'm saying? But
yeah.
But there are things we could do to work towards that. And that's what I was trying to allude to.
No, that's great, but I mean, because you have Paul here in the VB world, you've created a lot of programmers who don't like to think about even the type that they're working with. So, this of course is going to span. The solution needs to span. We can't just come up with a really cool solution in C# and no one's saying that we will. But let's talk a little bit about the sort of the breadth type developers who they aren't necessarily pros and they aren't super skilled, but they need to get something done. How does
you mean
work
like
for
parallelism?
In a language like VB.
Well, I mean, I think I was thinking about when you were talking. Like a good analogy for this is, like what happened with memory management in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the old C programmers. I mean, you did all your memory management yourself. You did all kinds of twiddling and all that kind of stuff, and then you move to the higher level and you give up a whole lot of things you could do down in the bottom level. A lot of grungy things. But at the same time, now you have all this nice memory management done for you. And I think that that's a world that the VB programmer lived in pretty much exclusively. I mean, we hid away all the details of, in the old COM days and,
mm-hmm.
what in ref counting and all the other stuff. Just, we took care of that for you and you just kind of had, there were a lot of things you couldn't do or you had to go through big hoops to get to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the great thing is you have the simple programming model. And I think that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. So in a sense, it's really really consistent with what we want, you know, how VB programmers work, I think, is that if we do this right and if we succeed in kind of coming up with a really high-level, nice programming model, it should fit very comfortably, where it's just sort of like, you know, you change, you'll have to change things and the way you program a bit, or you give up some things you used to be able to do, but probably most VB programmers weren't doing that anyway. Most C-sharp programmers probably weren't doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it actually is not a really scary thought, at least, you know, I mean, with some of the level that you have to work with for parallelism now, it's very scary. Sure. I mean, even I struggle with it, like, when I'm trying to introduce it into my programs. But, you know, but with the direction we're headed in, I think it's really, I think it'll be great. I think,
very cool. Yeah. I'll say one thing about the way to get productivity for people doing parallel programming is to somehow safely give them the illusion that it's single-threaded, because people are really good at thinking single-threaded, and we have all these developers who are really good at that. What we need to do is provide the right patterns or the right building blocks that enable them to have that illusion and have it in a good way, like the illusion in a good way, meaning I act like my program is single-threaded, but when it's executing, it's safely executing in a concurrent fashion. Uh-huh. That's the way to make it a mass market and highly productive thing. And the challenge is to find the right building blocks and patterns and things like that to make that
well,
happen.
Well, yeah, no, I would say maybe a little bit differently. I would say don't take the notion of threading out of the equation altogether, right? And allow people to specify their algorithm, you know, and have it execute.
Yes.
You know. Without them having to think about exactly how that executed, you know, that's going to be a stepwise process. But I'm pretty bullish that we can make some progress.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And of course, we're interviewed a logician over in MSR recently. Yuri can't pronounce his last name right now, but one of the things he said is that we're sequential.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we're trying to design these parallel problems, but
we're stepwise
sequential.
And
we're exactly.
Sequential, right? Yeah.
Brains work that way.
Yeah, I do.
That's how
so.
We are.
I think that is very true.
There's another thing that we are, is that we are language processors. Like, we were so good, and kind of from a very early age, like a bunch of us have young kids, you know, people are taught to read and write languages. And so when we look at kind of the evolution of programming language, we're really looking at from a kind of a linguistic perspective of, how do we provide languages that are good and fun to read and write? And we're so good at it that we don't think about it.
Right.
But it is those representations are very powerful. And they're really the way that developers communicate to one another and to the machine. And that's what we think about when we're evolving.
Right. I guess staying within that paradigm then, the trick then is to make the operations that you do sequentially, to make those boxes big enough that you can think of them as sequential. Come in here, come out at the bottom.
Yeah.
But inside the box, there may be all sorts of concurrency going on that you don't have to worry about.
Absolutely.
Right? That's really, in a sense, what we're talking about.
Outstanding. Well, hey, I know you guys have real stuff to do now. I mean, this is we've taken up part of your real meeting. And so thank you again for coming on to Channel 9 and sharing your insights with us.
Thanks for coming.
And looking forward to seeing what comes out of the box with C# 4.0.
Thanks for stopping by. We still need a quote of the day, so we better get going on
that. Yeah, there might be a couple in here.
Don't we have donuts for having donuts? I think
yeah, that could be a quote. Yeah.
A candidate.
Very cool. So I'm going to end on you since I missed you. Cheers.
Thanks.